After his death, the chef, author, and travel documentarian was memorialized in many spaces. But a new book tries to shed further light on Bourdain's childhood, his life growing up, some of the challenges he faced, and, of course, achievements he claimed. Bourdain, the definitive oral biography, was written by Lori Woolever, and she sat down with WDET's Sam Corey to discuss the book and her relationship with Anthony Bourdain.
I first met him in 2002. He hired me to write, to edit and test recipes for the Anthony Bourdain's Layal cookbook, which was his first cookbook. At that time, I was expecting pretty much the voice that I you know, got to know from Kitchen Confidential. I was expecting that person personified. And the person that I met was actually much more quiet and shy, even a little socially awkward and sort of introspective and not terribly comfortable, really, you know, sitting at a table full of people having a meeting about a cookbook. I was surprised by all of that. I expected sort of the storyteller, raconteur, you know, smoking a cigarette, drinking a beer, and he was a much more measured person when I first met him. So that was, my first impression was something like surprise.
Yeah. Yeah. He certainly had a lot of multiplicity to him. He also had just a sort of grandiose personality and really threw himself into whatever it was that he's doing. You really captured this quite well in the book. I'm curious why you think he gravitated towards cooking and being a chef.
Well, I think that he came to the restaurant industry as someone who was a little bit lost and quite young and unfocused in his academic career and in his professional ambitions. And he found it something that was, there was a fun, there was a camaraderie, there was, an excitement and energy. And there was sort of a meritocracy of it didn't really matter who you were, where you came from, what kind of schooling you had. If you could prove yourself on the dish station or on the on the stove, you could move up quickly and have a find a place in this sort of pirate crew. And I think all of that really just appealed to him on some elemental level, that he felt that he had found this sort of rowdy family that he was looking for as a young person. And it was a family, some of the members changed over the years, certainly, but it was a form of family that he, was with for nearly 30 years as a professional cook.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that I'm not sure a lot of people know about him, maybe some people are discovering now, certainly through your book, is that he wanted to be a fiction writer and that he actually published two fiction novels before getting into nonfiction and certainly getting into television. He really had a deep hunger to be, it seemed like, a famous fiction writer. I'm wondering if he was ever a little bit disappointed that his novel writing career never took off quite the same way that his nonfiction did and his television did.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not entirely certain of the answer. I think he really put as much effort as he possibly could into writing two very entertaining, funny, and well-structured and fast-paced novels. I think it speaks to the marketplace at the time. It speaks to the specifics of the publisher and, his initial publisher and editor talks about that experience of putting these books out into the world. And for whatever reason, they just didn't hit in the same way. So I think there was some disappointment or some surprise, but I think he also was very, very proud of just having done it. I think that he was just to have written a novel, published it with a major house and gotten a little bit of notice for it and perhaps made his advance back, I think was, at the time before Kitchen Confidential broke through, I think that was still exciting, and still felt like a worthwhile endeavor. I do know that he, he continued to sort of blur the lines between fiction and nonfiction when he was making television. He took a very strong creative stance and definitely drew from some of his favorite novels, some of his favorite films. And I think he always sort of was injecting that novelist's sensibility into whatever it was that he did that followed the writing of those two books.
Yeah, it definitely shows up in so much of his work. And I think people really felt it. When he was first getting into TV, he was shifting the book A Cook's Tour into a television program. And I thought there was something really interesting here that you write that he wasn't really into it until he got to Vietnam. And then he sort of came alive. I'm curious what it was about Vietnam or the experience of being there that really gripped him and sort of shifted him into a mode where he felt like he could be himself and, I don't know, really express something.
Yeah, I think that, well, the big trip that he took with his producing partners, Chris Collins and Lydia Tenaglia, right at the beginning of his television career, there were two destinations, Japan and Vietnam. And Japan was the first. And I think there was just a huge contrast. First of all, Japan was the very first. So he was the most nervous, the most unsure of himself and uptight. And they were, as Lydia says in the book, they were shadowed by these handlers and fixers who had a lot of very well-studied etiquette and protocol in mind. And, you know, Japan in some ways is still a very, very formal society. There's a lot of rules. There's a lot of things that are just very different to an outsider. And so I think Tony felt sort of hobbled by all of that and also just very nervous as being someone who was new to being on camera. And so Vietnam was right after that, and it wasn't as if he had gotten so much experience in Japan that he suddenly was comfortable. But I think that just the cultural shift and the difference in the way that things run there, plus this sort of fantasy romance idea that Tony had of Vietnam because of all of the reading that he had done and all the films that he had watched about the place. He was a big Graham Greene fan, and Apocalypse Now was one of his favorite films, and he had certainly read quite a bit about the CIA in the 50s and 60s, and he was very, very much a student of history, a student of international politics. So he came to Vietnam armed with all of this information and all these ideas. And I think it was just very exciting for him to be in this place that he knew so much about, that he had read so much about, and that he was finally getting to do something and to move through space and make his own television after just being studying it from afar. The heat, the humidity, the food, the sort of chaos of the streets, I think all of these things really just spoke to him on an elemental level.
I know you comment about this in the book, but I've heard this in so many different places that he taught Americans to travel and move around the world with a sort of a level of curiosity and openness. And really, you know, I don't know if he worked to do it, but he certainly avoided the ugly American trope that I think a lot of people fall into. I'm curious, where do you think he learned that? Where do you think he got that from?
Well, you know, Tony's family, they didn't travel extensively. They didn't have a ton of money, but they did travel a little bit. They went to France a number of times, and that's detailed in the early parts of the book by his brother Christopher. And of course, he also wrote about it himself in Kitchen Confidential. So it wasn't as if he hadn't traveled at all. And he also was just raised by people who, for whom, you know, good manners and cultural curiosity and, respect for others, I think that was just sort of part of the fabric of who he was and how he was raised. And although he certainly marketed this other side of himself as being sort of irreverent and thumbing his nose at society and, you know, being a rebel and an outcast, at his core, he was, a very well-mannered, very respectful person. So I think that is a part of it. And I think he also wanted to distinguish himself from, earlier generations of travelers who had just sort of come like, latter-day colonists and not behaved well, not represented their country well. I think he was very aware of all of those tropes and wanted to subvert them and wanted to, you make much better television and you get much better interviews if you're respectful and open-minded and you know, behave in a way that that maybe starts to change the cliche of the American. So I think he was just mindful of it from an early age, and it's something that he carried through throughout his whole life.
Yeah. When things really started to kick off with him, with No Reservations and Parts Unknown, particularly, he became quite popular. Obviously, very famous. A lot of people knew him, and it changed his life. I'm curious how you think fame sort of changed him.
I can only speculate and draw on the words of the people that I spoke with for the book, because I didn't meet him until after Kitchen Confidential. But I think from what I understand from talking to people that there was a part of him that didn't really change. You know, he was consistently kind of the same guy, very wide-eyed, enthusiastic for the things that he was interested in, very romantic, very susceptible to, a new obsession. So I think those things remained about him. I do think that he, I think he became more sort of cynical and weary in a way, you know, having seen so much of the world, having seen, the suffering that some people are subject to in different parts of the world, and the miseries that are common to many parts of the world. I think that did sort of age him and make him a little more cynical, make him maybe a little sadder about things. But I do think that there was kind of a consistency throughout his life that, you know, whether he was a 17-year-old dishwasher in on Cape Cod, or a 60-year-old writer, television host, in Rome, he was essentially a guy who was very open to new experiences and really excited about the things that moved him.
Yeah. Yeah. He also was quite generous, and this comes up time and again in the book. At a few different points in his career, you note, and other people really seem to realize that he's really burned out. I think at a few different times he says that he just can't give it up because he's financially and professionally supporting too many people with his work. I'm curious, I think this is sort of a debate in the book, but I'm curious whether you think that's true, or that he just couldn't give up the work because he wanted so badly to throw himself into something. He cared about it so much, and he wanted to be sort of like full throttle, and he wanted others to appreciate sort of the work that he was producing.
Yeah, I think there's a lot. I mean, there's this truth to both sides of it. I think that he was in some way, you know, he was an addict. He was, and I don't think he identified as such, but it was to me, it couldn't be more clear whether it was drugs or alcohol or work or relationships or jujitsu or, you know, whatever it was, he was in 1,000%, and he really had no ability to moderate his interaction with these things. So I think work fell into that, and I think it was, I know I have the best job in the world, and I am so lucky, and it's very, very difficult to walk away from something like that. I think he also really felt the burden of leadership, and that's a chapter in the book where, he was aware that because of what he was doing, he was really floating a small industry of people making the show, of people like myself and, you know, his publishing partners and his agent and, you know, the nanny and the mortgage, all of these things. You know, when you're successful and when you're the name, you're the guy, you know, it really means something when you decide that you've had enough and that you're going to walk away. I would like to think that his feeling about that was a bit distorted. I mean, all of us certainly would have been sad to see him stop making television, but I feel confident that I would have been able to continue working with him. I know that his television crew were certainly well positioned to go on, and certainly many of them have gone on to do really fantastic things since he's no longer here. But I think there was just a lot of conflict, a lot of sense of, I asked for this, I built this thing, and it would be selfish of me to walk away now.
Yeah. You noted that he was an addict. Of course, you know, he's open about being addicted to heroin. Many people in the book note that he was always sort of trying to fill up a void with something. You sort of noted it earlier, you know, whether it was work or jujitsu or romance. I'm curious what you think were the things that were more stable for him. And if this was really his true dilemma of trying to find sort of a stability through the things that gave him drive and passion and not sort of burnout or, you know, going for such a high that it wasn't sustainable.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that is something that he struggled with throughout his life. You know, he had periods of stability. He was married. His first marriage was 20 years. You know, he had, you know, the same career in the same city for a long time. But that wasn't that, you know, that didn't prove to be enough for him. I mean, his ambitions were greater than that. So, and unfortunately he didn't necessarily find a way to balance out, you know, the sort of burning ambition, with the things that you know, gave him some stability and some calm at the end of the day. I think it was something that he, consistently looked for, and he just wasn't able to strike the right balance. You know, he had a second marriage, that was, I think it was about 10 years, maybe 11 years. And that was, you know, for a while, a source of consistency. I think the show for a while was a source of consistency, but it's true that if if there isn't more sort of balance between home and work or travel in a way, you know, sleep and rest, all of these things that that just wasn't the frequency he vibrated on, unfortunately. You know, when he went for something, he went for it 1,000%, and there was, you know, frequently collateral damage.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, Tony was loved by a lot of people, and when he completed suicide a couple of years ago, it really struck people. They were really grieving, and I know it really included a broad swath of the public. I'm curious, Lori, if you published this book in part to offer a sort of public mourning, to give the general public an opportunity to sort of grieve with this person that they came to know for many years in the public light.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've heard from a lot of people who've read the book that's you know, how they experienced it, reading it through the first time or listening to the audiobook. You know, I think that Tony's death just left people with a lot of questions. And some of them, I hope that many of them are answered by this book. You know, I think there always will be some things that are just impossible to know, and questions that are impossible to answer. But I think that this book, you know, hopefully will help people understand a little bit better how someone could go from seeming to have everything and having the perfect life and getting to travel the world and you know, pursue one's creative pursuits, how someone could go from that to, you know, making the decision to end their own life. And I think it's always people like Tony, anyone that's a public cultural figure, they're always more complicated than we are allowed to know, both by their own sort of efforts to obscure the deeper parts of themselves, and just by the fact that, you know, being on television is it's a flattening medium, you know, and you're only going to get sort of the top 15% of what a person is, what makes up a person, the whole of their experiences. So I think, you know, this book was a chance to sort of understand this is where this guy came from. These were his struggles early on. These were the things that his friends saw, you know, as time went on, that were consistent in his character. So, you know, some people were angry, and the anger was definitely part of my response to Tony's death and his decision, you know, to end his life. And I hope that people can work through and resolve some of that anger as well, you know, and understand how somebody gets to such a desperate place.
That is author Lori Willever.
Her brand new book is a definitive biography of Anthony Bourdain, called Bourdain, the Definitive Oral Biography. She spoke to WDET's own Sam Corey here for Culture Shift. This is 101.9 WDET FM. We are Detroit's NPR station.